Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to At The Yard. Along with Jim Salisbury, I'm Corey Seidman. Appreciate you checking in, and a reminder to please subscribe and rate At The Yard wherever you listen to podcasts. And this is a good day to be doing At The Yard because this morning, Mike Trout and the Angels reportedly reached an agreement for a $430 million deal over 12 years, ending that fantasy of Mike Trout someday joining the Phillies. Jim, what was your initial reaction when you saw the report of the terms of this historic deal?
It's a staggering amount of money. You know, the Phillies signed Bryce Harper, what, 2 weeks ago to the largest contract in American sports history, and his tenure of holding that record appears to have lasted 2 weeks. And $430 million is $100 million more than Bryce Harper got. Just staggering. You know, I know there was a lot of, as you mentioned, fantasy about him donning a Phillies uniform someday. But I've always thought that the owner of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, Artie Moreno, would do everything in his power to ensure that Mike Trout stays in an Angels uniform and goes to Cooperstown with an A in his hat. I just don't think you let Mickey Mantle get away. You talk about an iconic talent. That's what that guy is. You want him going into the Hall of Fame with your hat on. And now they have to put a team around him so he can go in a World Series winner someday. And, you know, he's got a lot of tread on his tires. He's got a lot of years left. I still think that's a great possibility. And I am just not surprised at all that once Harper set the bar, that the Angels and Trout would go to work on getting over it. And we're at the 100-year anniversary of Harry Frazee, the Boston Red Sox owner, selling Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees, letting him get away, letting him become the world's first big sports superstar, maybe the ultimate sports superstar, in a Yankees uniform. And I just didn't think that the Angels were going to let that happen, and they haven't.
It is $35.8 million per year for Trout. So it's about $10.5 million more annually that Trout will be paid over Bryce Harper. Trout is also a couple years older than Harper was when this extension was reached for Trout. But, I mean, this just shows how he's viewed around the game, that he doesn't really have peers. This is one of the greatest baseball players of all time. And I've always kind of shared your sentiment that you just expressed, Jim, that I could never see the Angels trading Trout because what would be full value for a guy like that? Who would ever want to be known as the GM that traded away Mike Trout? And that's why, really, until this spring training period began and Bryce Harper started making those bold claims about what he was going to do and try to recruit Trout and kind of maybe crossed a bit of a line there, not until that point did I start to think that it was a realistic possibility. I would think that Harper's comments, I'm curious what you think about this. Do you think that Harper's comments kind of sped up the process for the Angels, maybe added a little necessity to their negotiations there? And quite frankly, to me, the $430 million figure, while it is a staggering amount, you always knew that it was going to take a ludicrous number to get Trout to forego free agency, right?
Yes. I don't think it was. I don't think Harper's comments had anything to do with this. I think this was a good marriage between the Angels and Trout all along. I think they were just sitting there waiting to see where the bar was. And like I said, they were going to go after it and go get it and get it done. I actually kind of disagree with you a teeny bit. I think there was a chance that they would trade him only if he went to them and said, there's no chance I'm signing an extension here. At that point, I think you have to think about trading him, and so be it. You know, the general manager traded him because he wouldn't sign an extension there. But, you know, everything I've always heard is Trout very comfortable out there, gets to come home in the winter and watch his favorite football team, and that's fine. But I don't think that Harper's comments spurred this along at all. I think this was long in the works, and there was long a desire on both sides to extend that relationship, and they have done it.
This also kind of highlights again why when you have a superstar free agent like Harper who's out there and you have a good chance of getting that guy and he's a fit, you just need to pounce, because Nolan Arenado, people dreamt about him as a free agent for years. He never reached free agency. Mike Trout, people have been making this connection to Philadelphia for years. It looks like it's never going to happen. Mookie Betts, who might be the next superstar to come available, I'd be stunned if the Red Sox let him get to free agency. So this kind of shows why you can't just look toward the future and those free agents who might get there when there's the good possibility that their teams extend them well before that.
Yeah, we don't know. Maybe there's going to be changes in the CBA that affect free agency, and that's, I think, that another reason that guys are pouncing on these deals. And why wouldn't you? The money is so good. You know, why risk going to, you know, taking a year, risking injury to get to free agency when the money is going to be at that level anyway? So I can't say I don't blame any of these guys. Arenado, I don't blame, obviously you can't blame Trout. It's a staggering amount of money. And it's just going to be interesting to see how free agency is going to change here in the next few years with more and more guys, you know, foregoing free agency for these big contracts to big extensions to stay where they already are.
Yeah, like what benefit would there have been for Trout to wait? I mean, what, the possibility of maybe getting $500 million? Like, when you're at a number this high, is there really a difference between $430 million and $500 million?
No. The only reason you wait is because you don't want to stay with that team. And, you know, it's L.A. They're talking about a new stadium. Things can change. You can put a team together quick enough that he's going to get to the postseason. He has a chance to win.
Well, that's the big question. That's the big question now is, can they put a team around him? Because during Trout's 7 years, his seven full seasons in the majors, the Angels have made the playoffs just one time, and they were promptly swept in the first round by the Royals the year that the Royals went all the way. In Trout's seven seasons, the Angels have averaged an 83-79 record. The Pujols contract has been a disaster. The Josh Hamilton contract was even worse. They haven't been able to keep any other starting pitchers healthy, whether it's Otani or Shoemaker or Skaggs or Andrew Heaney. So there's definite concerns about whether they're going to be able to win. And there were a lot of, should I say, salty Phillies fans that immediately had that reaction that, yeah, he just signed away his contract to play for a losing team. Well, that might not necessarily be the case. I would think that if you pay Mike Trout $430 million, you're committing yourself to really trying to win over the next dozen years, kind of the way the Phillies did with Bryce Harper.
I agree. They just need some. They got to put some pitching together, and it's going to take some time, but they can do it.
Okay, so now let's move on to the Phillies' actual roster, guys who are actually going to be playing for this team. And you know, the opening day roster, we're about a week away from really having an idea who's going to be in that picture. On the position player side of things, has anything changed, Jim, for you in your outlook since the beginning of camp, maybe in terms of how many bench bats they're going to carry to open the season or which outfielders may be a part of it?
Well, you know, I still think for the long haul over the season, they'd probably go with a 4-man bench and an 8-man bullpen. Now, could that have a little different of a look the first week of the season? Possibly, because there are three off days in the first, I think, 8 days. So, you know, they could even add an extra arm in the bullpen if they wanted to early on. But, you know, not a lot of surprises overall. I think coming into camp, we thought, you know, it could be Odubel Herrera or Roman Quinn in center field. But Quinn, I don't think he's going to be ready. He's not going to know enough at-bats. Herrera looks like he's going to be ready. So I think he's your center fielder. We know who's in right. We know who's in left. McCutcheon. And we know the infield. We know the catcher. We know the opening day starter. So I don't think there's a ton of surprises. You know, maybe on the bench, I think they'll, you know, it'll be Kingery and Nick Williams, I think, probably gets there with Roman Quinn opening up on the DL likely. And the bullpen, you know, you think Tommy Hunter can open up on the bullpen. That might allow a guy like Arano, who has struggled this spring but was very good last year. Maybe that allows him to get that final spot. Maybe it's Ramos. We'll see. But I'm not anticipating a ton of roster drama here in the last week.
You mentioned the early off days. Based on the schedule, Aaron Nola, if he pitched on regular rest, would start three of the Phillies' first 8 games. So I'm curious to see whether they're going to go with that or they're going to give him an extra day, you know, because it's a long season. But that was my thinking, just in that it's not a guarantee that they open with a four-man bench. They could afford to open with a five-man bench and carry one fewer pitcher just because you might not need a fifth starter until the second or third week of the season based on the way off days play out.
And that's very possible. It's very possible. They haven't tipped their hand on that yet. But you know, it's something that they could definitely do. The risk you run is you don't want to ice a starter too long. You know, you want to get guys in there because they're coming out of spring training, they're stretched out, they're ready to go. But they definitely can manipulate things a little bit because of the off days.
The two position players that I would look at right now is kind of, you know, on the bubble, probably not going to make it, but they could if they produce over this final week, or there's an injury. Phil Gosselin and Sean Rodriguez. You know, right now the Phillies project that opening day bench you just went over, the only backup infielder would be Scott Kingery, because then you're looking at Nick Williams and Aaron Altherr in the outfield and Andrew Knapp, the backup catcher. Is there any chance you think that either one of those guys could play their way into this roster on opening day, whether it's as a backup first baseman to Rhys Hoskins or just a utility infielder for Gosselin and Sean Rodriguez?
Yeah, I would think it's possible. Like, if they added an extra guy on the bench and subtracted a pitcher for the first week, it's definitely possible. Both guys are versatile, and they love versatility. Gosselin's had a very good camp. Rodriguez has a wealth of big league experience, as does Gosselin. So I think one of those guys could be in play, definitely, if they want to, you know, scale back on the pitching staff early.
Last week in Bradenton, when Jake Arrieta was on the mound, and he didn't have a great outing, but Sean Rodriguez, first two innings of that game, made two diving catches, one on a short hop, one on a hard hit line drive, kind of showed off his ability at first base, not just a guy who can stand there at that position, but actually be a quality defender. So curious to see if he remains in this organization past the end of spring training. The two outfielders that we've talked about here as opening on the bench, potentially, Nick Williams and Aaron Altherr. These are two guys who, you know, they may not spend the entire season in Philadelphia. I would think that Nick Williams has some pretty solid trade value on the open market. I'm not quite sure what the ideal return for a guy like that would be. Still very young, still very inexpensive relative to outfielders around the league. And he's shown over the last two seasons, Nick Williams, that he can be a starting caliber outfielder. Where do you think this situation with Williams goes over the next few months? Do you think that the Phillies are content to hang on to him until they find the perfect offer? Or do you think that they're going to want to kind of figure out this outfield, this roster crunch, sooner rather than later?
I think you have the luxury of hanging on to him until you find an offer you like, for the simple reason he has options. You can send him to the minors and he can play every day. He can continue to improve. You can have him in your system as depth. If you have an injury, you can plug him in. He also can help you off the bench in the big leagues immediately. He was very good as a pinch hitter, especially early last season. And then the other way he could help you is as a trade candidate. But I think he provides very valuable depth right now, and I don't think they're eager to give that away. If they get the right return for him, though, I think they would definitely listen.
Does the right return, I mean, just you, in your opinion, what do you think is the correct return given the roster context the Phillies have? Is it a starting pitcher? Is it a bullpen arm?
It depends. I mean, you could be offered an A-ball kid that has a really high ceiling. Maybe he's an outfielder that's a power bat that in 4 years you think you might have some. Or you could go after a major league ready guy that could help the back end of your rotation right now. We'll see. There's definitely a lot of different type of returns you could seek. It's all about what somebody's willing to give you and what your organizational needs are. They have needs at the big league level, but they're going to have needs 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. Maybe you target somebody who helps you then. I don't know that there's a perfect blueprint for trading Nick Williams. It's about getting value. And sometimes, you know, the value impacts you immediately, and sometimes it impacts you down the road. Those are things that they have to weigh.
You know, the Phillies are probably looking at it from the standpoint of, this is a talented young player, similar to the Cesar Hernandez conversations of off seasons past, that you don't just give this guy away because, you know, you may have added depth at a certain position. This is a player who can still provide value in the case of an injury. This would be a next man up type of situation. So, yeah, you don't just give a guy like that away, even though you're going to enter the season with pretty much a set outfield. Good news for listeners outside the Philadelphia area. You can see Jim and I throughout the season on our pre- and post-game shows with NBC Sports Gold Philly Pass. Go to nbcsports.com/PhillyPass and use the promo code PhillySports, that's one word, for $5 off the annual price. Jim, one of the other big stories this week was the Carlos Santana TV incident that surfaced, that Santana smashed a TV because he was unhappy with the amount of video game playing that was going on in the Phillies clubhouse last season. What were your initial impressions of that? I'll say that myself, I was surprised that Santana did so, just because he always came across to me as a very mild-mannered guy. He kind of shows you that you don't always see what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it was surprising to hear that. If I think it was mostly out of frustration for the losing, because I'll say this about Carlos. I wrote this at the end of the last season, talked about it. I thought a lot of guys mailed in that final month. A lot of guys quit on the season. There were guys nicked up that had no desire to get back in the lineup, and he posted every day. And he went out there and played 16 games at third base, which is not even his position, and he did pretty well. So I thought he played hard to the end, and I think he got frustrated that some guys did not play hard to the end. I think he got frustrated that they were losing so much. And, it's hard to decipher the truth here, whether or not he witnessed guys playing video games during the game, as he is quoted as saying, or whether or not this didn't happen during the game. And maybe he witnessed guys playing before the game, as other players say. Because I've talked to guys to say that nobody played video games actually while the game was going on, because in the video room, the analytics department has all the computer screens. So how could you be playing a video game? Who knows? It definitely explains why Capper wants a tighter clubhouse and tighter rules this year, as he alluded to early in spring training. It does not reflect well on Capper and his leadership last year, that if what Santana says is true. Capler himself said he was unaware of guys playing video games during the game. But, things are obviously going to have to change. Who knows? This happened in a part of the clubhouse. Just so you have some perspective, I mean, the Phillies clubhouse is a lot more than just an area where guys get dressed to play a game. I mean, there's about 10 rooms in that clubhouse structure. And, nine of them are off limits to the media. The only room that's really accessible to the media is the open area where the lockers are, and nobody plays any video games in there. You might see a guy looking at his phone at 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but this happened in a faraway club area of the clubhouse, off limits to the media. It happened on the second to last day of the season. On the second to the last day of the season, apparently they had a team meeting about it. They talked it out. A bunch of guys talked, and it was agreed that it would be kept in-house. And then some way, shape, or form, 6 months later, Carlos Santana talks about it. Phillies players have disputed the veracity of his comments. I mean, who knows? But one thing you do know is that they need to run a tighter ship around here, and they're going to try to address that.
Yeah, it sounds like they will. Jake Arrieta, didn't he tell you guys yesterday in Clearwater that video games will now stop an hour before games? Is that correct?
That's what he said. Yeah, that's what he said. This goes on everywhere. The guys, spend so much time in the clubhouse. They come here at lunchtime, and they're there right up until midnight. And sometimes in the back room, I guess they do play video games and stuff and unwind. That's how some guys lock in. Some guys will sit in front of their locker and watch a movie. That's how they get their focus on. Everybody's different. But if this indeed did happen during a game, that's an egregious offense. That can't happen. You have to be on the bench supporting your teammates. And I don't blame Carlos Santana one bit for being frustrated, for the simple reason I thought he carried himself pretty professionally. There's probably other ways of handling your frustration than smashing up stuff, but apparently he paid for it. But like I said, this happened way out of the public eye. Arrieta says it happened late at night. And people came in the next morning and found out about it. They had a meeting. They decided it was going to be kept in-house. A day later, the season ended. People went on their way, and all the focus turned to the off-season. And, Phillies players were very surprised that it had come up again. But it did, and maybe something good will come out of it. Maybe there'll be a little more focus. There has to be, because, like I said, it reflects poorly. Whether or not Gabe Kapler is a good leader is not the question. It simply, perception-wise, reflects poorly on his leadership. And with an improved roster and higher expectations, this is just another layer of pressure that's put on Gabe Kapler. So he's going to have to go out there and win some ball games with this improved roster if he wants questions to go – the questions about his leadership some of which were fueled by this latest Santana story. If he wants all that to go away, he needs to win ball games and really win them quickly.
You know, you use the word perception there. I remember that in September of last season, there was a game that we went to the clubhouse. It was a blowout loss for the Phillies, one of what seemed like many over the season's final 6 weeks. And as soon as we got into the clubhouse, two guys who weren't playing in that night's game were like yucking it up really loud, playing ping pong. It was a spirited game. And look, I know that these guys aren't robots. You got to unwind however you want. You mentioned that some of these guys are there 10 hours a day based on the time they get to the ballpark. But it's just the perception of it. It wasn't a good look. You know, you had a somber team after another blowout loss. They were fading from the standings. And, you know, here you have two guys who were just boisterous in the middle of the clubhouse on the ping pong table. It just didn't feel right. And, you know, I guess maybe that was some of Carlos Santana's frustration, is that you had guys who were really giving it their all in the month of September, and maybe not everybody felt that they could look to their side and see their teammates doing the same thing. But look, with this Phillies roster this season, you have an infusion of veterans, McCutchen, Realmuto, David Robertson, to go along with guys like Neshek and Arrieta. To me, this looks like a proper balance of veteran leadership and youth. And, you know, I would think that the Phillies last season learned from it. It was the first year of Gabe Kapler as manager. Kapler was focused on letting guys be themselves, whether that meant how they wanted to look, what time they wanted to arrive, things like that. But I would think that last year was a learning process for Kapler as well, wouldn't you?
Definitely a learning process for Kapler. He's been very open in admitting that. He's a very accountable guy. He's talked about all the things he learned. He's talked about making adjustments this year, and he's not going to switch up the lineup as much. I mean, part of that is just that he has better personnel that he can lock in there. But he's very open-minded to making adjustments. But, you know, he's always, I think, been – because he was a player fairly recently, I think he wants the players to police their clubhouse. But I do think he needs to put the hammer down now and then on certain things because – you know, one guy might be sitting in front of his locker trying to prepare for a game. He doesn't want to hear ping pong balls. So one guy might decide that he gets his competitive juices going by playing ping pong. There's got to be a happy medium, and things have kind of got to be shut down, you know, an hour or so before the ball game so everybody can lock in. Ultimately, it's going to come down to wins and losses. If they lose, people are going to keep picking apart Kapler's leadership. And if they win, it's all going to go away, and focus is going to be on how well they're doing. I mean, let's go back to last year. Going into August, people were talking about Gabe Kapler as a manager of the year candidate.
They sure were.
Okay, they were in first place. Then they started losing, and they put the dunce cap back on them again. It's all about winning. It's all about winning. If they had won last season and they played a lot of video games, well, it was because, you know, they kept them loose in the clubhouse. They were a loose team. They were a loose bunch, and it showed on the field. They were able to relax and play well. Well, you start losing, it's because you're screwing around in the clubhouse. You know, you got to win. Winning takes care of everything.
It's the power of narrative right there. It's the chicken and the egg debate. You know, does chemistry breed winning? Does winning breed chemistry? I think last year was a perfect example of it. The first 4 months of the season, the Phillies did appear to be a loose bunch. And, hey, this team is too young to know better than the fact that they maybe shouldn't be this good. And then it falls apart, and then you start pointing fingers. That's just, you know, the nature of sports. Jim, I want to end with this one, totally different topic here, but just something that's been on my mind a lot as I've watched this Phillies rotation in spring training. This is a very big year for Vince Velasquez. Ton of pressure on him. The fact that the Phillies are now supposed to be a contending team, there's going to be more eyeballs on him than ever before. And, you know, this is his fourth season now as a big league starter, a guy who's projecting to pitch a full season. We haven't seen a ton of consistency over the years from Vince Velasquez. He has the big fastball. His secondary pitches don't flash quite frequently enough the way that they should for a big league starter. I'm curious, do you think that he is going to last a full season in this Phillies rotation? How do you think the organization views him? And where do guys like Jared Eichhoff and Drew Anderson figure into this situation? Drew Anderson, for example, has looked very good in spring training.
I see Drew Anderson and Jared Eichhoff opening in Lehigh Valley and putting pressure on that back three in the rotation. And that's good internal pressure, good internal competition, because competition makes you perform better. And if that is what pushes Vince Velasquez to finally, you know, put some consistency for him in the big league level, then that's a good thing. And that competition is going to push Velasquez, Eflin. It's going to push Pivetta. But you're right. I mean, Velasquez has to show more consistency this year. He has to put it together. He has to get deeper into games. The talent is there. The potential is there. He's worked with a mental skills coach. He says he's more focused. He's made a mechanical tweak. You know, we're going to see how it works. He hasn't looked great in spring training, but, you know, when the light goes on, if he's going to get a shot, and if he doesn't perform, I do think this is the year they're going to have to do something. I don't know if you put him in the bullpen, but by something, I mean that if he doesn't perform, they're going to have to replace him because I expect them to contend, and I don't think they're going to let a year of contention slip away. If they need a pitcher, they're going to go get Jared Eichhoff, who's foaming at the mouth to get back to the big leagues. They're going to go get Drew Anderson. They're going to go get Ranger Suarez. And if those guys don't do the job, they're going to go get Madison Bumgarner. They're going to be involved in trade talks with other teams. They're not going to let a year of contention slip away because they have a hole or two in their rotation. They're going to go out and fill it. They didn't sign Harper at $330 million and get, you know, Realmuto and get Robertson, get McCutcheon and improve this roster to not make the playoffs this year. And if they have a hole in their pitching staff, like I said, they are going to address it. So it's up to Eflin, Pivetta, and Velasquez, and beyond them, Eichhoff. It's up to them to prove to the front office that, no, you don't need to go out and get a pitcher.
Yeah, and that's kind of why these last few weeks I've just looked at the, you know, you have Dallas Keuchel and Craig Kimbrell still out there, but to me, the financial flexibility, the wiggle room, you might find a better fit in June or July than either Keuchel or Kimbrell is for this team right now. Jim, I lied. Last question I wanted to ask you. If you got $430 million, what sticks out to you as something that would be one of your first purchases?
You know, I don't know. I'd probably pay off a few college educations, if you know what I mean.
There you go. That's a very responsible answer.
I'd start there, and I would take you out to dinner, Corey. You and Steven. I would take you guys out to dinner.
What a guy. Yeah, I mean, for me, I was thinking that the first thing I would do is just hire like a world class personal chef, because I hate getting home from work after a long day and then, you know, standing over the stove and making food for myself. I don't have enough patience for it. So that would be my first purchase. I'm curious to see what Mike Trout does with this life-changing money for generations and generations of the Trout family.
Everybody says these guys make too much money. Somebody was just saying that to me yesterday. And I said, the world pays for talent. And Mike Trout has a lot of talent. And he's already been paid once, and now he's getting really paid again.
Yeah, he's going to end his career with like $500 million in earnings, maybe even more. Just
more.
So
more.
Crazy
I
to think
more,
about.
Yeah.
Yeah, because his contract now was what? It was 150. So add those two together. Wow, that's just insane to think about.
He could buy all of South Jersey.
Maybe that's the plan. Maybe that's the plan.
Maybe he could buy the Eagles someday.
People are already saying that they should revoke his passes to the Link now because he signed this deal. Philly
he
fans
might build
gotta
a new
love
stadium
him.
And put might build a new stadium and move the team to Millville.
That's going to do it for this edition of At the Yard. For Jim Salisbury, I'm Corey Seidman. A reminder to subscribe and rate At the Yard wherever you listen to podcasts. Have a good week, everybody. We'll be back on Friday.